It's not a gold case if someone buys a gold bar. And we're seeing non-crypto cases, per se, that actually result in a lot of the big digital asset seizures.
It's funny, I saw a case. It was a massive VAT fraud case out of Europol. 17 countries, massive arrests. And the case involved a yacht, 3 million euros, several cars, a Rolls Royce, a BMW, a Range Rover, jewelry, luxury watches, 2.5 kilograms of gold, and there was some crypto. And it struck me when I read this press release being like, oh yeah, this is kind of, I think, where we're headed with this, where crypto will be a piece in almost every investigation.
It's like saying you have internet in your case. It's like, no, they've used a smartphone.
That's exactly right. So for me, the best example of this is when I was a prosecutor, and this is going to date myself, I was given a pager to go to court. So if any of my colleagues needed me or I needed one of my colleagues, I could page them. Drug dealers were also using pagers. We started to see a cell phone in cases right here and there. I was issued a cell phone eventually. Then we started to see 10 cell phones in every case, and then hundreds of cell phones, right? And now we do cases involving just cell phone bulk smuggling. That is where we're headed with crypto.
Hi, I'm Lo Furno, one of the producers of Seize and Desist, the Asset Reality podcast. In this episode, recorded on the 13th of March, Aidan is joined by Ari Redbord, the global head of policy at the blockchain intelligence firm TRM Labs. Before that, Ari served as the assistant United States attorney for the District of Columbia. Ari is well known for his insights on cryptocurrency fraud and financial crime, as well as his podcast, TRM Talks, where he regularly sits down with business leaders, policymakers, and financial investigators from around the world to talk about the most pressing policy, regulatory, and enforcement issues in the crypto sphere. In this episode, Aidan and Ari will explore why criminals are so drawn to traceable technologies like the blockchain, how mixing services facilitate money laundering, and the crucial role of blockchain analytics in dismantling these operations and seizing their ill-gotten gains. Whether you're new to the world of seized asset recovery or you're a seasoned professional, you're sure to learn something from this eye-opening episode. Seize and Desist is brought to you by Asset Reality. Thank you for listening.
Ari Redbord, I think our paths originally crossed. I was trying to dig it out. I think it was one of the various events that we were hopping about as the world was sort of re-emerging from COVID. And I was noticing, who's this guy on LinkedIn that keeps running everywhere? There's me trying to do running, and then you're like basically started this running club as well, sort of blazing past me. So yeah, that's a big part of your life, isn't it? You've done, I saw recently you're a big marathon runner and
yeah,
just one or two under your belt.
Just a few under our belt. It's fun. Look, you mentioned the running club, and it's like you and I both are traveling all over the world. You know, you're having conversations, you're having meetings with folks. It's really like the coolest Zoom meeting you've ever been on, right? You're running next to someone, you're talking about their job, their career, their family, and it's just like this fantastic opportunity. And I actually show up for the run, right? Like you're in Vegas, then you're out till, you know, late early morning hours. If you've told 20 people that you're going to be in the lobby for a run that morning, you're going to show up. So it's also massive motivation for me. But yeah, no, it's been really fun and just one of those kind of neat things that, I don't know, kind of caught fire and people actually show up for this thing.
You started your own running club now.
Definitely.
But it is true because people, especially in this sector, I've noticed now, I'm sure you're saying the same, there's, you know, the same names, the same sort of people pop up. But the truth is you really don't know people. You really don't know like behind the persona. It is sometimes finding that. And I think particularly we'll talk a bit about your previous career. You know, a lot of the times that, you know, people see people on LinkedIn, people see people chatting about this, you know, this topic that I hold very dear, but, you know, not realizing that it's a hard job at times. It's tough topics. It's not, I mean, there is no nice way to approach terrorist financing. There's no nice way to talk about online exploitation and human trafficking and pig butchering. You sometimes need a bit of lightness and a bit of levity and things.
I appreciate that. I mean,
we're all humans.
Yeah, no, I think you and I have really, I think, bonded over that, just kind of having that feeling in the space. And look, people ask me all the time, I'm like, oh my God, it looks like you're having so much fun. And my answer is always like, it's because I am, right? And I am because I get to engage with these really, really cool people who are really smart, who are building cool things. There's a lot of energy around. And the running thing is just sort of like doing cool things with cool people. If you get to do that at any point in your career, you got to jump at that opportunity. And I see you do that every day. And I'm lucky enough to do that every day as well.
I think people, you know, people are often not accountable, not responsible for their own sort of like their own happiness. I mean, like people say that to me a lot. I always sort of gush about the fact that, no, I love my job and I love doing what I do. And I think a lot of people used to just think that in the past, just when I had an employer. And I was like, yeah, of course you would say that. And I'm like, well, I said even more now that that me and a bunch of sort of people have founded a company, because it's the same. If you don't enjoy this, it's hard to turn up. Like, you have to genuinely sort of have that sense of mission. That's the whole point of this sort of Season Assist podcast, is that there's no agenda. We're not trying to sell products and sell software. We're truly trying to get to the bottom of why is it that only 1% is this estimate of assets that are actually seized from all of the illicit assets, trillions of dollars. And there's just a fundamental problem with asset recovery, and that too many people have sort of separated church and state and think that digital asset and crypto is a completely separate conversation, where it's just a subsection within that. It's like talking about vessels within asset recovery. And what we're trying to achieve is by looking at it as an asset category, but the difference is it does deserve its own deep dive as a subject. It does deserve its entire ecosystem conversation, because we're seeing that it can be the sort of beauty and the beast simultaneously. It can be the antidote to all of the problems and the blueprint to tremendous asset recovery. And we're seeing all these $1 billion seizures, which you know a lot about. But we're also seeing that on the other side, it also becomes the easy clickbait that it's the problem and it's the terrible issue that is affecting financial crime and money laundering. And you're sort of at the very sort of cross section of all of that. So if you wouldn't mind taking a few minutes, sort of explain to us how you got here. How do you get to this point that you're sitting on sort of these illicit finance hearings in the US? You're sitting alongside my dear friend Carl Hauser giving evidence.
Yeah.
How did Ari get to this point? Aside of all of the running, take me a bit through your career so far.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate it. And before I do, I'll just say that, like, I love the Beauty and the Beast thing, and I've never actually heard that or thought of it that way. Look, the promise of the technology, this idea of cross-border value transfer at unprecedented speed and scale is extraordinary, right? For remittances, for humanitarian aid, for all these wonderful things. But at the same time, illicit actors also love cross-border value transfer at the speed of the internet at unprecedented speed and scale. And that's the nuance to the conversation. But what I usually say is, like, look, what takes us sort of over that is this ability to track and trace the flow of funds on blockchains. I love that Beauty and the Beast part. I think what gets even more complicated oftentimes than what we do at TRM, and I'm sure we'll get into that, this tracking and tracing, is what you do, right? And that is, how do you take that tracing and tracking and ultimately have a result in a seizure or asset forfeiture or the like? About me. All right, I could do that. So by way of really quick background, I currently am the global head of policy at TRM, and we can sort of talk through that lots in the next little bit. Prior to that, I spent about 11 years as a federal prosecutor for the Department of Justice in Washington, D.C. I spent a lot of that time on kind of the intersection of money laundering and national security, what I call threat finance. So really stopping bad guys from getting the money they needed to do bad things. So terrorist financiers, export control cases, sanctions, criminal prosecutions, narcotics trafficking, anything that sort of had a national security implication, and money laundering. Those were the kinds of cases we were working on. It was awesome. Every day I got to go into courtrooms and say every red board for the United States. You know, I was able to represent the government to go after pretty bad actors. I then went over to the U.S. Treasury Department about 6 years ago now, I guess, always still working on those types of issues. I was a senior advisor to the Deputy Secretary and the Undersecretary for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence, and that's really the office that oversees all the national security apparatus within the U.S. Treasury Department. So OFAC, which is the U.S. sanctions regulator, FinCEN, which is the financial intelligence unit, right, the money laundering regulator for the United States. There's a policy shop called TFFC, an intel piece called OIA. So really sort of anything that implicated national security and money is really sort of was our major focus. And yeah, it was really an extraordinary opportunity, I think, to move from being a prosecutor where you're just tunnel vision to your specific case. Hey, this is the case I need to prosecute today in court, and I'm not worried about anything outside of that, to include policy, right? I'm not making policy, I'm just prosecuting cases, to, hey, this is a very high-level view from the U.S. Treasury on the ecosystem. How do we engage with the FATF, the Financial Action Task Force, right? How are we engaging with global regulators? Should we do this sanctions designation with HM Treasury, or do we go alone? Like, there's all kinds of interesting conversations to be had there. And it was fun to sort of so have the prosecutor piece and the policymaker piece. And then I did this crazy thing about 3.5 years ago where I left 15 years or so in the U.S. federal government and went to what was about an 8-person startup. And
the only reason my startup exists is because other people made similar decisions.
And honestly, it was the best professional decision I ever made. We're about over 200 people now across about 40 countries, and it's been a real adventure. But I think we kicked this off by talking about, like, doing cool things with cool people. And I've been lucky enough all throughout those different segments of my career to be part of great teams. And that's true at TRM today.
Well, so when you think about that, because that must be difficult, because if you imagine, did you actually come across, or was there any accidental exposure to crypto cases when you were a prosecutor?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. So honestly, for me, it was North Korea. We were looking at North Korea money laundering, and it's not what it is today, right, where they're attacking crypto businesses, crypto ecosystem. It was really money laundering in Bitcoin, 2016, 2017. I was like, wow, you know, this is really interesting technology, and there are tools to track and trace it, but it's obviously being used by cyber criminals. I want to understand it more. And I was lucky enough to be a part of a number of big cases involving North Korea and money laundering that had a crypto nexus. Folks like Chris Jancheski, who's now a TRM from IRS, and Nick Carlson, who is our expert on TPRK. I was working these cases, Kyle Armstrong from the FBI. We were working those cases together when I was a prosecutor, and they were agents, investigators, analysts. That was really the sort of first time. I will say from a policy perspective, when I got to Treasury, Libra launched, Facebook sort of failed crypto project, for lack of a better description, stablecoin project.
But it helped at least push the conversation to a much more public debate.
It was critical, Aiden. Like when they write the book on these early days that we're all sort of engaged in, to me, Libra is its own chapter, right? This idea of access to stable coins, right, that are backed by a basket of fiat currencies and the world's most important companies with access to like 400 million user Facebook users freaked out regulators across the globe. I jumped on a plane with my boss and we flew to Switzerland to meet with FINMA where they had registered. It really, really caused this conversation to mature super quickly. U.S. Congress freaked out. Maxine Waters was calling hearings and putting Mark Zuckerberg up there. I think it's actually really sad. They ended up putting together the team that you absolutely would want to have running a business like this. Stuart Levy, former Treasury senior official, was the CEO. All kinds of things. It did everything right. It was just A, ahead of its time, and I think B, associated with Facebook, which was a company that a lot of policymakers were skeptical of.
We're purposely targeting a specifically non crypto audience. We're trying to help the generalists in this sphere. So you've got Facebook coming along who want its own stable coin, its own currency, effectively. And everyone freaks out because there is the sheer power that they would have because they have already got so much data. There's already Netflix specials and the Britney Kaiser exposés, and you've all this, you know, storming towards, like, you know, Brexit and countries being overthrown and, you know, manipulations in Cambridge Analytica and all of this sort of like juggernaut. But like, help me understand from a layman's perspective, take out the social media company, what's the difference between that and one of the big, and I'm not trying to name names to pick on people, but a USDT, something like that, or any of the other big stable coins that are fundamentally backed by, or there are private companies, private organizations underneath with their own complex corporate structures. Are they sort of hiding in plain sight a little bit and sort of have crept up? And not the opinions of TRM, your own personal opinions as a former prosecutor, is it a case of we are all of a sudden we kind of lost our banks, it was too early, but over here it's like, well, what's the difference? Like, why is there not the same level of scrutiny? Maybe there is, but I'm just not seeing it in the public domain.
Yeah, it's interesting. Look, from what I saw at Treasury and still like having engaged with Libra, which eventually became called DM, even in my time at TRM, we were working really closely with them. I thought it was an incredibly responsible player, right? Like, I remember when I was at Treasury, we were having conversations. I don't talk about this very often, but it's crazy stuff. Like, we were having conversations about exactly what we expected from an AML program for Libra. And at every turn, they essentially did what we asked. I think that they hired the right team. They were putting in the policies and procedures. And I think it was doomed to fail because of sort of the association, as you mentioned, with the sort of what was happening in the social media space and the concern around big internet companies, essentially big social media companies during that time frame. For look, the sort of purpose of the layman, you have a circle today, which is to me one of the very best, most responsible players we have in the space, which is doing a lot of the same things with some of the same team that Libra had back then. I think probably just A, the time was not right then, and the time is much more right now. And again, it doesn't have the sort of connection to a giant social media company like Facebook. So I think a company like Circle is doing it in an incredibly responsible way today, but so was Libra, frankly, in many respects back then.
Even just participating in these hearings, getting involved, having people on the ground, because I think that it is that classic thing, and I think that's why people get confused, because they look at something and go, well, hold on, if I apply the same metrics to both of those things, why was there different outcomes? And it is accepting that sometimes it's just timing. If you tried to get a Bitcoin ETF off the ground, you know, 5 years ago, you wouldn't have had the same sort of reception, and we keep trying to sort of, you know, tell people. I still personally on the side do visiting sort of lecture work, because I really enjoy seeing people having that oh heck sort of moment. I remember when I was an investigator, and the concept of real realizing you can trace all of this. I often use the example of like pinning the tail on the donkey. All this stuff's going around. You just got to connect the offline identity with this online transactions, and you can see investigators' eyes light up, and then they start to realize like the sheer opportunities for this. And that's why with me, as you sort of hinted at this, it does need to have its own special category, because never every time something new comes along, there's always that, you know, threat first, risk first. Whereas when you see what's happening right now with some of the stable coins, again, they've just got so big that it's people like kind of don't know what to do with it. I was looking up before the show, Tether is a private company, and it's now making like $6 billion profit, and it posted like $2.8 billion just in the last quarter, $100 billion market cap, and was it a BVI registered company? And I think this is where people just sort of their minds get blown, because they're like, but hold on, didn't we hear all of this with a company called FTX, and they had lots of assets and lots of money, and what should we do? And you're like, no, that's different. Different how? Is it regulated? No. And it's actually banned in New York. So this is where I think people forget that when we're trying to tackle asset recovery, we're speaking to, you know, prosecutors and judges and police officers. Maybe this is their first time coming across this. And we get into the habit of throwing all this stuff across people's desks and expecting them to not go, all seems just peculiar. How do you, when you're in your role, you do this so much more than me. How do you sort of have those first conversations? Let's say that you're going into a country for the first time and you're trying to help someone sort of understand, getting the balance of that, embracing the economic opportunities, but also not being too open for business or sort of bad actors. How do you sort of like do that dance when you first meet a country?
I think it's really important. It's not even when you first meet a country. I mean, this is ongoing conversations over and over in places that super sophisticated, you know, policymakers and regulators like the US, like the UK.
As people retire and people move in and out of jobs, yeah.
All kinds. It's a constant conversation, but I think it's an important one in that, look, you know, I'm not a rip and replace kind of guy, right? Like, I know that this idea was like, hey, we're building an entirely new financial system and it's going to displace intermediaries and banks and financial institutions. I've sort of never seen it that way, right? Like, I think there are opportunities to do financial services, to move money on blockchains, which to me is like a true tech upgrade on the current rails that we have today. And it's important because open public blockchains are these immutable ledgers where you can track and trace funds in ways you never could before. That's good for anti-money laundering, for sure, which is obviously the software that we build at TRM, but it's also good for a lot of other things, to include market integrity and consumer protection, understanding markets, right? Being able to measure the impact of the actions that you take, right? You know, we can get into some of this, but over the last few years, we've seen the US Treasury, FCA, Europol, FBI, others take pretty significant actions against crypto-related businesses. In the past, we would pretty much have to speculate as to the impact of those actions. Today, we could actually see the volumes on blockchains pre and post sanctions or enforcement action or criminal prosecution. We could never do that before. You know, we'd spend hours and days and weeks sitting around, you know, conference rooms and secure facilities at Treasury trying to understand the impact or potential impact of sanctions. We could do that today by just looking in real time at volumes through exchanges, through mixers. So there's a lot you can do now. Yeah.
I don't think that actually a lot of people will appreciate like the simplicity. I often get called out if I sort of say this at events or webinars. I get people coming up and asking me afterwards and like sort of fact checking. But I don't think people realize that you'll be better placed than me to describe it. Like a Madoff style case where you're trying to unpick a corporate veil with a series of financial transactions in different jurisdictions. What is the timeline of what that normally takes versus unpicking a large scam that's been run and involves the blockchain?
It's absolutely extraordinary. And you're absolutely right. Look, when I was a prosecutor, I investigated cases involving networks of shell companies and hawalas and high value art and real estate and diamonds, right? There are no TRM to trace those things, right? You can't do it, you know, but at the same time, crypto allows you to move funds faster and in larger amounts than ever before. And those transactions are very hard to undo, as opposed to sometimes in the traditional financial system where you can undo wire transfers and the like. So it's this really interesting paradox. I fall on the side of, look, blockchain technology provides so much value to investigators. You know, anti-money laundering to me is actually a feature of this technology, not a bug, despite what you hear from some policymakers. So I usually fall on the, hey, you know, moving funds on blockchains is safer, is more secure, and is easier to regulate and do financial crime investigation on. But I get that, you know, now ransomware actors can ask for larger amounts of funds much faster than they could in the traditional world. So it's a paradox.
It is like the, I often use this sort of cheesy movie quote. I think it's Spider-Man, which I always remember. One of my first bosses told me when I first became a criminal tax inspector, they were like, with great power comes great responsibility.
Exactly.
And also with my Northern Irish accent, I can't say par. So I say, I guess you do the thing that in golf, if you get the same same score as the golf course. It's same thing. Power of par. And I think that that's, I've sort of sat in the position that you often talk about. If we're helping a country and it's kind of like you've got one side of the house over here demanding Bitcoin is banned and all crypto is bad and it's all awful for money laundering and terrible things. Then you've got the other side going, well, the middles are going, well, it's a new thing and we can investigate it. And if anything, it has more guide rails and more possibility to track and trace and shut down and find and recover assets. And people often forget as well, like even just the evidential opportunities, even if the money's gone and there's no assets to seize, like being able, I've seen people, like really brilliant investigators, take what they found on the blockchain and say, well, we've seen that he emptied the wallet after we kicked in the door. It's been put onto a hardware device and we can't find it right now. But that's been enough to get international freezing orders in different, you know, countries, because they've now been able to prove to a judge they're trying to put their assets beyond use. Like this wonderful sort of like set of breadcrumbs that's been left. Like, do you think that, because again, thinking back to I always use my dad as the benchmark. Like if I was explaining to him, like why is it that banking, we had this traditional sector, new technology came along in sort of internet computing and mobile devices. And it's like everyone can accept that's just an upgrade on the technology that allows these sectors to work. Why do you think that, and it's not a trick question because I know a lot of people will be going, well, because it cuts banks out. But it's seriously, why is it that we're not seeing, or are we starting to see it now with JP Morgan and BlackRock? Is it treated with skepticism? But because from the layperson, it just looks like if we flip it the other way, instead of going Bitcoin and it's a them or us, if someone looks at it as, this new technology's come along, actually allows us to do AML and KYC much more accurately. It actually allows us to move transactions even faster. Like if you banks and financial sectors go build on this and build in all the automated screening, we are actually going to do a very much better job than we're doing in the current global financial sector, where we have trillions laundered in TradFi that we kind of just give up. And it's like, could be 2 to 5 trillion. We don't know. But why do you think there's that skepticism? I don't think it's just cost. Surely it's not just like commercial opportunities.
No, it's a great question. I actually don't think it is necessarily commercial opportunities. I think you see some of the banks sort of, you can see some of that happening, the lobbying and all of this sort of against tech. I think it's a couple things. One, look, you know, Bitcoin in particular was born out of the financial crisis and the sort of distrust of large institutions, of governments. It came alive with this sort of libertarian ethos. And I think for the most part, that was great. And the technology was fantastic. But I think that we developed sort of this meme crypto bro sort of culture, crypto Twitter around it, that caused a lot of and talk about it in a lot of tech jargon and sort of new vocabulary, where look, if we only talk about it the way you just did, Aiden, like this is just a new tech stack to a very old problem, and that is, how do you move money, or how do you really move anything? And to me, it's all a big tech upgrade more than anything else. You know, you talk about central bank digital currencies, for example. I don't know if we should have one or we shouldn't, but I know it shouldn't be a red meat political issue. It's just a tech upgrade potentially on what we have today.
Traditional banking, you're paying for a coffee with an Apple Watch. Like no one's losing their, but there always will be those people that scream.
It's all digital money.
Yeah, it's all digital money. Like when was the last time we withdrew cash? Yeah.
That's exactly right. We all use digital money. I still have to pay to get into my kids' basketball games with cash for some reason. They make me pull it out. That's about it. You know, I was paying babysitters for a while, and now they just want Venmo. And the fees I pay on that, right? I think we've done some bad job in messaging as an industry over the last, you know, decade. But I also think it's early. And I know we keep saying that, but it really is early. When you talk about the internet, right? I mean, it was years before the average person was engaging with the internet in a meaningful way.
I actually have a Daily Mail article that I use in presentations. And I think it was something like early 90s, mid 90s. And it's like, the internet, it's a fad that will never catch on.
Yeah.
Was the headline.
Yeah.
And it's true. We talk about, if you think about what banking has gone through since the early 70s, like to say to someone, you're going to have a plastic card you can tap, you're going to pay with your phone, you're going to be able to, you can go to an ATM and not even find your card anymore, even if you wanted to withdraw cash. It's the advances. But I agree that because it's started off in that polarizing position, it's kind of like, I have two teenage sons and I sort of think about kids using Snapchat and like, you know, before, like the grandparents use it, and it's just going to go through that cycle that it's just going to become normalized.
I think that's exactly right, and Jeremy Allaire talks about this from Circle, and I did a TRM Talks with Dante pretty recently, and I asked him about this as well. They talk about the tech has to recede right from the conversation. We got to stop talking about protocols and blockchains and mixers and bridges and all of this tech and mining, and it just has to be like, you pull out the phone and you tap it and you keep it moving the way you do with Venmo today. That's when my mom will start using this technology.
It's like sending a WhatsApp. No one sits down and goes, I've got WhatsApp on my phone. Let me talk to you about encryption.
WhatsApp is an awesome example. Look, when I was a prosecutor, WhatsApp was being used basically by terrorists and law enforcement, right?
Simultaneously.
End-to-end encrypted.
Law enforcement has a group. The terrorists have a group. Everyone's using WhatsApp.
I now use it for my child's like parent-teacher association, right? Like bad guys are early adopters of great tech. And that's what we're seeing to some extent today in the crypto ecosystem. But like everyone now uses WhatsApp, Signal, these types of messaging apps because they're great. They're good tech.
It is kind of like ignorance is bliss. Like the amount of people that have pinned their location or shared their location with me. And you're like, do you know who's actually looking at that or tracking it? Whereas the same people like lose their mind over the government's trying to ban crypto and trying to take my privacy. And you're like, the irony that you're complaining on Twitter or X about your privacy, unless you are actually in a bunker can peaches guy, like you don't get the right to have that argument about privacy at the extent at which you want it. And I said in an episode with Carl, we were talking about, I think when you've worked in our collective worlds of law enforcement or prosecutor, and when you've seen the horrors, I think it's a valid price to pay and an entry point. When you see what people do, when you don't enforce efficiently, we can't live in this sort of utopian world. In the same way, one of my favorite comedians is Jim Jefferies. His gun control argument, which if you haven't watched it, you should look on YouTube. And he sort of poses that, you know, Lewis Hamilton should be able to drive his car 200 miles an hour if he wants. No, because he has the ability, but he can't. He has to walk as, society can only walk as fast as its slowest member. And he's going, the same reasons we have to have gun control and the same reason we have to have controls on cars. And, you know, government tells you what you should eat and what you should drink. And they tell you what age you should get married at. And if you want to be a normal society, if you want mainstream adoption, you got to accept that you can't have your own special category. But I also agree that some governments don't do a good job by just having an overly simplistic view and kind of ignoring the atrocities in TradFi and sort of pointing at centralized exchanges, whereas like only years ago, are we still seeing recent prosecutions in banking? And it's had decades to get it right. And we still have Sinaloa cartel. We still have great money laundering scandals affecting banks and 1MDB.
Where I land on all of this is, and you'll hear hopefully comes throughout the program today, the conversation is that like pretty much any issue that we're having in this space, whether it's how to regulate it. In the US, there's this conversation about what are securities and what are commodities. We deal at TRM and you at Asset Reality deal with, you know, the money laundering piece and the seizure piece and the criminal enforcement. I believe there are tech solutions to every policy, regulatory, investigative issue in this space. And I think that like what I love is to see people building it. It's the kind of stuff that you're building, the kind of stuff that we're building and sort of beyond. As we approach these issues, I always want to approach it from like, how can we use the tech, which is really good today, to solve these regulatory issues?
And it's the blessing and the curse, because the technology that everyone's frightened by also contains all of the solutions. And we've seen this in the sense of, I would love to hear your sort of your take from a former prosecutor and your policy job and in what you're seeing and building a TRM. Is that sort of life cycle, just to give people a bit of an example, we want to sort of zone in on investigating and the possibilities around the blockchain. We've seen these $1 billion seizures. And when you come from my regular asset recovery world, where $1 billion seizures were not a common thing, and they're just happening so much in crypto, what is the reason for this phenomenon? Is it lots of assets, appreciation in value, or is it the tools are making it easier to, you know, it's sort of fishing with a trawler net as opposed to a pole?
Yeah, I would submit all of those things, really, honestly. You know, you mentioned $1 billion seizures. Let's just talk about the biggest one ever, right? The seizure of the funds from the Bitfinex hack. So essentially, walking through the life cycle, in 2016, there was a hack on the Bitfinex exchange, which was one of the largest exchanges at that time. The hacker stole about $70 million in Bitcoin and then began to launder those funds. And they laundered them through every obfuscation technique you could imagine. So for folks listening, it's like they move them through mixers, which jumble up different cryptocurrencies and send them out so they're harder to, on the other side, so they're harder to track. They move them in and out of darknet markets, which are markets on the dark web through the Tor browser that are drug markets and other types of illicit activity. Move them in and out of there just to obfuscate the transactions, right?
It's just like someone with a stolen painting just moving it through multiple hands. They just try and create...
Moving it through multiple layers.
Money laundering 101.
Yep. They move the funds across different blockchains to make it harder for investigators to follow those funds. They were able to off-ramp some of them and convert them into other things like gold and gift cards. And they used privacy coins, which are harder to trace, one called Monero. They were laundering these funds over and over again, but what they couldn't do is find an off-ramp, right? You need to be able to take these funds and move them through a cryptocurrency exchange, because the reality is we can't really buy anything with crypto today.
But isn't that exactly the same? It's like me stealing a million dollar heist in cash.
Yep.
I can't buy a house. I can't buy a car unless I'm willing to do tiny little transactions. So it's even when I hear people talk about off-ramps, I'm like, it's not just a crypto issue. That's it.
It's not.
If I give you a Picasso and go, well, there you go, buddy. That's your share of the Louvre that we've just robbed today. You still got to get it into the normal system to pay your kids' school fees and buy a Ferrari.
It's very hard. Exactly. And, you know, look, you can layer the layering stage of money laundering. I think you can do at scale in crypto. It just becomes very, very hard to do any of the other stages, right? Particularly integration. And that is, you have to find those on and off ramps. And ultimately, 5 years later, because investigators were able to track and trace those transactions, they were able to go back in time when the tools like TRM got better and able to watch those funds move. They were ultimately able to trace those funds to a single wallet address and ultimately were able to find out more information about that address, were able to execute a search warrant, and then find information that they needed to find in order to seize those funds. So private keys, specific information that allowed them to do that. So my point is, in large part, look, like, that's how this works. So an event happens, whether it's a hack or a movement of illicit funds, law enforcement is able to track and trace those funds in real time on blockchains, or even go back in time, because the blockchain is forever. Every transaction is logged and immutable. So you can go back when the technology gets better to trace through mixers, to trace in privacy coins. And law enforcement is able to do that. And to put a point on this, it was the largest seizure of anything in history. $3.6 billion, because that $70 million over those 5 years increased exponentially in value. And they were able to make arrests and ultimately get a guilty plea and cooperation in a number of other cases. So huge investigation, huge seizure, but really all because of the native qualities of public blockchains.
And I think that's something we're going to dive into shortly, but it is the evidential piece that I think is often massively overlooked, because it doesn't always have to result in a seizure. And similarly, we're seeing a lot of cases right now, the Bitcoin fog case now and the recent big sort of conviction there. It's not necessarily that you're just going after the criminal to get an asset seizure. I mean, this is just a category. I was speaking to someone recently, the advent of cars coming onto the scene, and you don't go to a court and say to a judge, let me tell you about the internal combustion engine or Henry Ford and the Model T to seize a car. We go into the weeds a little bit too much. But then when we think, oh, cars are dangerous and they drive too fast, well, now we've developed things like camera networks and ANPR systems, and actually we're able to track these cars, and we've got serial numbers on these cars, and we can track them around the world. And there's always that rat race of, you know, innovation and sort of technology sort of always keeping up. I use the example of like that particular Bitfinex hack. It's kind of like, you know, like dropping gold in the middle of a rainforest somewhere. You know it's in this particular area, but it's going to just wait for the technology to catch up. And now you've got like thermal imaging and all this wonderful stuff that you can just fly overhead and go, it's there. And I think that's the exciting bit, because there are so many cases, there's so many interesting companies being developed at the minute that will retrospectively look at, you know, hardware devices and be like, you've got a bag of laptops in a property locker in your current police station that actually could have artifacts for crypto seizures. They could have seed phrases. You could recover those assets. For me, it's incredibly exciting that you basically have struggling asset recovery sector. You've got a new category that's very valuable. And that same category has also brought us the tooling that will affect overall asset recovery cases. And tell me a little bit about them. These are not all just crypto cases. And if anything, we're seeing when people forget that, yes, there are pure someone running a mixer. There are pure cases where someone, but just before we jump on the Bitcoin fog, talk to me a bit about the fact that you're now seeing, you were saying, more cases where as just a pure asset category. It's not a gold case if someone buys a gold bar. And we're seeing non-crypto cases per se that actually result in a lot of the big digital asset seizures.
Yeah, we really are. And this is, I think, something that you and I saw coming for a while. And that is, like, right now there's a cadre of investigators globally. We know them all essentially from whether it's US federal law enforcement, UK Met Police, Australian federal police. There's a handful of investigators all over the world who do this, power users of blockchain intelligence type tools. And they're dealing with every sort of case where, you know, crypto case, for lack of a better description. We're seeing more and more where every case there's some crypto nexus, right? Because crypto is being used more and more by lawful users for value transfer. So you're just going to inevitably see it more in cases. And I think we're just starting to see that more. We recently did a study at TRM about law enforcement engagement with cryptocurrency. And one thing we found is that most cases don't start off as cryptocurrency related investigations per se, but ultimately potentially end up in that way. It's funny, I saw a case end of February, so really just a couple weeks ago. It was a massive VAT fraud, VAT fraud case out of Europol. 17 countries, massive arrests, and the case involved a yacht, €3 million, several cars, a Rolls Royce, a BMW, a Range Rover, jewelry, luxury watches, 2.5 kilograms of gold. And there was some crypto, right? There was some crypto. It was part of a much sort of broader case. And it struck me when I read this press release being like, oh yeah, this is kind of, I think, where we're headed with this, where crypto will be a piece in almost every investigation.
It's like saying you have internet in your case. It's like, no, they've used the smartphone.
For me, that's exactly right. So for me, the best example of this is when I was a prosecutor, and this is going to date myself, I was given a pager to go to court. So if any of my colleagues needed me or I needed one of my colleagues, I could page them. Drug dealers were also using pagers in all of their work. And everyone had one, right? Doctors had pagers. We had one guy at the U.S. Attorney's Office that would process all of the electronics. We started to see a cell phone in cases right here and there. I was issued a cell phone eventually. Then we started to see 10 cell phones in every case, and then hundreds of cell phones, right? And now we do cases involving just cell phone bulk smuggling.
Well, the Europol EncroChat.
Yeah.
They are now creating their own encrypted networks.
And the reality is that, like, that is where we're headed with crypto, where there's crypto in every single case. It's not some novel. I think arguably we're in the golden era of like crypto investigations. You know, Andy Greenberg wrote this book, Tracers in the Dark, which I think essentially like captured that time. That is a very unique moment in time, in my opinion, because I think we'll see much more of this, but it'll just be part and parcel.
I liken it to right now, we've got big railroads going in and out of the Wild West.
Yeah.
And with these railroads are filled with valuable things. And this is why they're attractive. And that's why you're seeing like North Korean proliferation. There's like, all of these asset classes. It's not protected as well as it could be. And they are literally like raiding parties just coming and grabbing the assets. And then if you've got everyday criminals being sold schemes, we've seen cases where these are like money laundering coordinators in sort of certain jurisdictions just selling schemes. And it's like, give me your regular criminal dirty money. We'll convert it in crypto because your local law enforcement, if we keep it low enough, just doesn't have the tools and training. So I still think there's a wonderful game of cat and mouse that we're going to sort of emerge
right
at the back of.
Yeah,
I still think we're super, super early.
Yeah.
With a lot of this stuff. We've skirted around the issue a little bit. Tell me about the recent Bitcoin fog case and why that is important and what that sort of means for the analytics sector in general. Because this was a big piece of evidential discussion. And also just for the lay person, the amount of people said to me, what is Mixer? Why are they not all banned?
Yeah, there's a ton to unpack here, so I'll try to do my best. Bitcoin fog was a Mixer, a crypto mixing service. And a Mixer, as I kind of mentioned, is really an exchange on a blockchain that you can move funds in and out of and mix them around, so it's harder for law enforcement or other folks to track and trace them.
And these aren't illegal right now?
These are not illegal, but I'll get to that in a moment. But like, imagine taking a bunch of dollar bills, you know, 100 $1 bills, and putting them on a table and kind of mixing them all around, so you can't tell which are the ones that were put on by certain people. That's essentially what a Mixer does on a blockchain. It's usually a smart contract that sort of runs that. And Mixers are not illegal, right? Mixers, there are lawful reasons to use Mixers. For example, in a world in which more and more transactions are done on open public blockchains, people are not going to want to watch, people have people watch every transaction. For example, I think we're going to live in a world someday where we are paid by our employer in cryptocurrency. Our employer will have our wallet address. We don't want our employer to track and trace every transaction that we do. I don't need my wife seeing how much I spend on sneakers every month. There are reasons you want to obfuscate your transactions. But there are very specific mixers, and Bitcoin fog is one of them. There was another one called Helix, which was also part of a criminal prosecution, that advertised on the dark net, Alpha Bay, which was the largest darknet market at the time, to launder funds for illicit purposes. That is not legal. That is money laundering conspiracy, right? That is conspiring with a darknet market in order to launder the proceeds of drug buys and drug trafficking and the like. So ultimately, the U.S. Department of Justice arrested a individual named Roman Sterling Gov, who was the administrator of Bitcoin Fog, for money laundering conspiracy, for essentially conspiring with Alpha Bay. Just this week, he was convicted on all counts to include money laundering and operating an unlicensed money service business, really for facilitating money laundering activity, for facilitating the ability of darknet market purveyors, drug markets, etc., from laundering the proceeds to try to obfuscate them from law enforcement. And one issue that came up really for the first time in a really meaningful way that was litigated is the reliability of tools like TRM, of blockchain intelligence tools, to be used in court. In the US, there's a very famous decision that we all study in law school called Daubert. There's another one called Kumho Tyer that talks about the reliability of scientific evidence. And this is as close as we've gotten to date for a judge finding that blockchain analytics tracing, blockchain intelligence tools are reliable, are to a scientific certainty in these types of cases, that presenting this type of evidence is something the jury should consider. I would still submit that it's one part of a larger toolbox that law enforcement has, right? Tracing funds on blockchains, ultimately using search warrants and subpoenas and other types of legal process. The asset seizure and forfeiture process that you're so involved in, Aiden, is all part of a larger process. But it was a huge win for the government for this idea of sort of using these types of tools in court. And the last thing I will say to all of this is, like, I'm a huge believer in the need for privacy and security in transactions on blockchains. Like, we can't live in a world where every transaction that lawful users do is open for everyone to see. But at the same time, we have to stop illicit actors from taking advantage of the technology. North Korea has laundered billions, literally billions, through mixers over the last 5 years. It is a huge problem. So the job for regulators, policymakers, law enforcement is, how do we stop bad actors from using mixers and still allow lawful users to operate in a secure and private manner? And I think prosecuting cases like Bitcoin Fog is exactly the way you do that. Go after the actors, right? The Bitcoin Fogs, the non-compliant cryptocurrency exchanges that don't have any AML controls. Go after darknet markets like Alphabay, like Hydra. Go after the illicit underbelly of the overall lawful crypto ecosystem. So in other words, going after the actors rather than the activity.
Yeah, because it is like the argument around the technology. You know, you don't sue the creator of the internet. You don't sue the creator of email because of their involvement in fraud. But you do expect internet service providers to, you know, be a bit of a barrier to entry. You do expect the phone company to have certain things in place and certain controls, and that's very relevant for the US. And I know it's an incredibly sensitive topic across the US, but, you know, gun control, again, sitting as someone who's a sort of European, when you've got places like a lot of the Scandinavian countries, for example, now people will be horrified to know that outside of those countries, the tax returns are published. You can see there is complete financial transparency, but then even citizens still want the right to be private when they want to. Do you think it goes back to that alt culture and the sort of the libertarian review? And I completely get that I'm a big supporter of the technology, but why is it so divisive? Why is it that if I Google a sort of Roman Sterling offer, I will literally find like reputable, credible people, the people that run VC funds, people that will be like going, this is a disgrace. You know, Ross Ulbricht, he should be freed. And I've got people over here celebrating that, like, not to comment personally on it, but why do you think it is still so polarizing? Yeah. Or is this just, it's so new and has so many moving parts to it that there isn't a simple answer?
I think
answer.
It's sort of like what's old is new again, or however that thing is, right? Like post 9/11, where my really career was formed as a prosecutor and in the government, this conversation was about airports and city streets, right? Like, what level of privacy are we willing to give up for a level of security? And we made decisions around that. That conversation continued. I think today, as we've moved into a digital world, this conversation is occurring on blockchains. And that's Tornado Cash, when the US Treasury sanctioned Tornado Cash, which was a truly decentralized mixer, right? It just ran on software. I think it started this conversation in a really meaningful way. I often go back and forth on ultimately where I land on this, other than to say that we cannot allow anything to allow North Korea, Russia, other bad actors to launder billions of dollars that are going to be used for destabilizing activity around the world. I've often heard people say, well, they use Microsoft Word to send ransom letters. Well, if Microsoft Word is being used at scale primarily to launder billions of dollars in North Korean hacked,
and that's its main use,
we might go after Microsoft Word. I've liked the US Treasury's playbook for this for a while, and that is mostly go after, and not entirely, but mostly go after what I would really call the illicit underbelly, right? Non-compliant Russia-based exchanges like Suex and Chadex and Garantex and Bitslato. Go after mixers like Helix and Bitcoin Fog. Go after services that are being used at scale like Tornado Cash. And
the ones that are blatantly in that category. I suppose it's like drug enforcement. You don't go after all the kids on the street. Like, every now and then you got to go after the big bosses, the ones that are so blatantly, you know, not someone that has a very liberal view on what they should be able to sort of consume. But it's like, no, you're running a heroin empire globally. You know, you're going to prison for a long
time. But at the same time, it's like, but then exactly balance that with allowing lawful users to engage with this technology. And I think there are technology solutions to this, right? At TRM, we are doing compliance for DeFi today, right? Decentralized finance. We are doing anti-money laundering, sanction screening on these front ends. They are building technology to do it sort of more at what they call the protocol layer, right? Where the smart contract exists. I think there's tech solutions to this today. I think mixers are going to have this type of technology, but I do think it's early. And I think we want to be really careful about going after the technology. I testified, as you mentioned, you know, a couple of weeks ago before the House Financial Services Committee, and one congressman asked us, all of us, different opinions, different backgrounds, to raise our hands if basically we supported a ban on mixers. And absolutely none of us, to include Carol, who was probably the toughest of this group on stopping bad actors, you know, on that shift between security and None of us raised our hands to that, right? I think we all believe that this technology is really important and privacy is really important. We just have to stop bad actors from taking advantage of it.
Let's ban the bad ones. In the same way, no one would propose banning the internet. And I think a lot of uncertainty, and it's probably for another show, where governments have to take a bit of responsibility is uncertainty and inconsistency and enforcement treatment is what's terrifying innovation. Because I know, as we've seen headlines around the world, how some countries react and go from one extreme to another. I'm conscious of our running out of time.
It's always so good.
This could have been a part one of four, but I'm super keen to hear about, we always give everyone the opportunity, the sort of magic wand and the sort of, we've been talking a little bit about what a lot of the issues are and the fact that we're completely in agreement that the actual industry has a lot of the solutions for how we go forward. But like, how did you have that first conversation, or how do you advise people to have that first conversation? Is it don't go in with the weeds? And what sort of resources, outside of TRM's wonderful resources, of course, what sort of things do you find? We ask people about what podcasts do they listen to? Where do they go for information?
I love that. Yeah. I'd say a couple things. Obviously, I always say follow us and TRM Weekly Roundup and TRM Talks and all of that.
We will share as part of the show notes, particularly the report you talked about. I really like those recent insights that talk about that these cases don't start off as crypto and they become crypto. So we'll share that in part of
that. That's awesome. But look, when you're a compliance professional, I always talk about you need to go read the enforcement actions, right? The crazy thing about regulators is that they are always sending a message far beyond whatever the actual action they take. So if you're reading enforcement actions from FinCEN and other global regulators, read what they're saying. They're providing their playbook, their roadmap on how to do compliance well, right? What you're supposed to have. Blockchain intelligence, geolocation, you're supposed to have these tools, right? So I would say read the enforcement actions, and they usually predate guidance, sometimes by a year, right? Enforcement actions are guidance and they're absolutely critical to read. If I'm a prosecutor or law enforcement trying to understand this stuff, there are so many over the last really few years, they're just starting to build this kind of case law around it. There's a lot of good complaints, a lot of good opinions. If you read the statement of facts in the Bitfinex case that we talked about, Aiden, I mean, it literally reads like a novel of tracing and tracking and watching these funds move. Read the recent decision from a couple weeks ago in the Bitcoin fog case on the reliability of blockchain analytics tools. So I would say look, if you're a practitioner, read the pleadings and the filings and what folks are coming out.
That is the source of truth, that is of actual things that are actually happening as opposed to someone's biased opinion.
That's exactly right. Because
that's what I struggle with. I'm just going straight for the author, because if I can sort of figure out the author's leanings, it's okay, I might be able to extract context from this, but if you don't have any experience in the industry, it can be, but I read this thing and it said it's bad, or I read this thing and it said it's good.
Yeah.
I get why it's difficult for people. Can I also ask about, you guys have played such an important part in trying to tackle scams. I mean, when we first sort of founded Asset Reality, we were trying to fix asset recovery. And one of the first things we did was sort of try and understand sort of scams more, because ultimately they are asset recovery cases. And the sort of sad realization we quickly dawned upon was that the infrastructure wasn't there. So if we go to government agencies and say, here's 1,000 cases that you can get these people's assets back. And it's we've never done a crypto case before. And all of a sudden we realized that our efforts are better spent actually working with governments and law enforcement and helping them change policy, develop legislation, go after the bad guys and seize assets. You've been involved in a couple of sort of brilliant initiatives, and I know that Aaron West has an entire episode to yourself to talk about this, so we've dove into victims in a very, very big way. But tell me about sort of your role in terms of that ecosystem of what you're doing with the TRM Fellowship, particularly around UpShamrock as well.
No, I really appreciate it. And Aaron, I'm excited to listen to her episode. She's always amazing and is doing incredible work. I think one of the challenges that she has is resources. It always is, right? While federal governments have more resources, still could use more. State and local prosecutors that Aaron works with really don't have access in most respects to tools like TRM. So what we've done is we've given, 100 or more licenses to state and local law enforcement that have applied to this program, the Tracers program, Tracers Fellowship, to allow them free access to our tool. It's one of the things I'm probably most proud of. I think folks who've come to TRM.
Do you know, I have to cut in. Yeah. I was in a financial crime unit.
Yeah.
In a jurisdiction that I'll not name, but thousands and thousands of miles away from where you're sitting right now. And I literally am chatting to the guy and he's like, oh yeah, we're getting some training. And he's like, well, actually, have you heard of a program called the Fellowship? I have access to this license.
Yeah, it's cool.
And I didn't realize that he was as part of the same scheme. So it's cool when you turn up in obscure sort of islands around the world and you're meeting people that have actually, that are benefiting. And I think they've just crossed nearly $10 million in crypto seizures. So we're sick. And that's the thing I'm reporting back to Aaron, going this is awesome. The more people we can get on this flywheel, and now they're going to their bosses and saying, we've got a case, can we get another case, can we get more resources? It's that jump start that I think the asset recovery sector needs.
Yeah, there's very little that makes me more proud than this. Like, you know, like we all got in this space because of the mission and getting to work at a startup that actually is aligned to these types of missions and working with law enforcement. And when you hear these stories about victims of pig butchering, we've done a couple little documentary type style things on our website. Folks who have lost funds, but who have been able to trace and recover, or law enforcement been able to trace and recover some of those funds. This has dramatically affected the elderly population. We have billions of dollars of victims here. And just like giving law enforcement the tools that they need is just absolutely critical. So something we're super proud of. This is a huge issue. I think sadly, by the time it gets to tracing, by the time it gets to where you sit in the asset seizure recovery place, it's usually too late, sadly. And that is not a very self-serving statement. It's just, it's a problem that we have today. We got to stop these scams from happening in the first place. And that's actually where I think Erin is doing her most important work. And, you know, you and I and others are doing anything we can to support that work. It's, what are the red flags? It's education. It's like, hey, we need you to think before you engage with this platform or this person. You know, I posted something on LinkedIn, which was tons of people actually responded to it and added their own red flags a couple weeks ago.
We met at the Digital Assets Summit.
Yeah, I saw it,
Denise and others jumping in on that.
It was really great. And I think that we just need...
It's like a collaborative effort.
We need more of that. And frankly, just more... Erin is absolutely everywhere. We just need more voices, more folks sort of talking about this. Because sadly, when you send the funds... it's often too late. We got to get people from stopping sending those funds in the first place.
It is kind of like that prevention. And obviously, we've seen sort of systems and what you're doing. Again, this is one of the benefits of things like chain abuse and some of the good work that's being done across the sector. But as you talk about, it's retrospective flagging. There's investigative opportunities. There's ways of shutting down the bigger networks. But that's not going to help that one person who's just sent their funds and hit send. And I think that's the most tragic thing about it, is that the vast majority of every case I've ever been involved in, there was that red flag. And some of these are such incredible complex social engineering, but some are other catching people on the hop when they could have just... And I think that's the thing that the sort of that we want to keep reiterating to people, that prevention better than the cure. And maybe that's where there is more to be done. And I know that there's exciting announcements sort of coming from Erin, was teasing at. Like we've sat in those rooms at Digital Asset Summit where we've had the likes of... Digital Asset Task Force, where we've seen, you know, all the representatives are there, all the big companies are represented, all the big social media platforms are represented. And I think the more that they can do to sort of take ownership, that realizing that they are being abused as an on-ramp, it is quite sad that some of them have pegged back on their compliance programs. And I think, unfortunately, until governments sort of create the stick to beat them with, just in the same way the cigarette industry profited for years and the oil industry continues to profit. Again, that's what I keep dragging it back to, that this is not a new problem. This is a brand new asset category that has all its teeth and problems that it will still find its feet, and we're like less than 10 years in. What would be your closing sort of thoughts, Ari, in terms of if you had a magic wand, what is the thing that we all probably have, that thing that we hear all the time because you work in the sector, whether it's a guy at a boarding gate or whether it's something you hear at a conference? I used to always hear, for example, my first crypto conferences in like 2017, 2018, the amount of people that were like, you're all going to be out of jobs. No one's going to work in conveyancing anymore. The blockchain's going to replace everything. And all this is just ridiculous hyperbole. Or you can't trace it, is the one that I always hear, and it's anonymous. What's the thing that irks you the most, that if someone takes away one thing from this sort of podcast, it's not to listen to that?
I think it's this crypto allows for, you know, more criminal activity, or crypto allows for anonymous transactions. I think the reality is that, like, we can now do financial crime investigations. We could do anti-money laundering better in crypto and more transparent ways than we sort of ever could before. That's like that larger sort of piece. If I had a magic wand, I would probably do a lot of what Erin is doing out there in terms of like education, getting the resources to law enforcement, to investigators, state and local and otherwise, that really, really need it, and really start to make more and more cases with this stuff. Because I think we're going to see crypto in more cases, and we need folks to have the resources to track and trace the flow of funds. Because honestly, you could be a lot more effective ultimately in crypto than you can tracing in the traditional, tracing asset and funds in the traditional world.
I often use the example that, you know, Madoff took 20 years, whereas FTX was 24 months. Like that's the sort of differences we're talking about in terms of the speed of the effectiveness of asset recovery in a positive way involving digital assets because of those breadcrumbs. And it's not just crypto seized, it's houses, cars, castles, plate, it's everything that's all been recovered. I hope that we're speaking in a couple of years and we're talking about the hundreds of billions of dollars of crypto that has been seized around the world, but actually that we're seeing evidentially, I think that's where we'll probably see the most benefit, is how this impacts. And once that starts to happen, like you mentioned, it's like Erin's point, if we we can have a network of errands and we can have this much more scalable around the world, it might make a bigger difference much, much faster.
Very, very well said. Thank you for a super fun, not surprisingly great conversation today, Aidan. It was awesome.
No, absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us. And like I say, we'll add all of the links into the show notes. Keep up the good work, my friend. And I was about to say, I would love to see you in a run, but I think at the speed you run versus the speed I run, I will cheer you. I will celebrate and add an emoji on LinkedIn.
Don't believe the hype. You know, couple miles, conversational pace.
I think I'm going to see you in Consensus.
Yes. I have never been to Consensus, Aidan.
Neither have I.
Oh, amazing.
Neither have I.
All right, cool.
I will commit to a run right now.
All right, tacos in Austin on me. Awesome.
Thank you very much, sir. Keep up the good work. Cheers, buddy.
We're grateful to Ari for sharing his time and his insights on cryptocurrency crime with us. Go and check out the TRM Talks podcast on your preferred platform or the TRM Labs weekly roundup newsletter on LinkedIn. Next time, Aidan will be joined by Jared Koopman, the Executive Director of Cyber and Forensics at IRS Criminal Investigations. They'll discuss how IRS Criminal Investigations became a world leader in digital currency seizures, why asset seizures are the only real deterrent for criminals, and some of the parallels between cryptocurrency investigations and Brazilian jiu-jitsu. If you've enjoyed today's conversation, like and subscribe to the Seize and Desist podcast on your preferred platform and leave a comment or any suggestions for future episodes. Thank you for listening. The views and opinions expressed by our guests are their own. Seize and Desist is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide legal, tax, financial, and/or investment advice.